Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 18, Episode 10. Coming up on this show, When Men in Black Invade Your Dreams, The Portal Princess from Pakistan, and Grant Cameron joins us to discuss the Charlie Red Star UFO flap of 1975. I'm Benjamin Grundy, joining me is Aaron Wright.
All set for a big show?
No.
No, not at all.
No, I feel like I have no business doing a podcast today.
You were pretty sick yesterday and you look pretty wrecked this morning.
Oh, I've been smashed since the Tuesday show.
Do you know, it's been one of the, I think it's H3N5 or something. It's one of the worst flus that's ever gone through Australia. People are just dropping dead. Like a 30-year-old in Victoria just dropped dead. So I'll leave that one with you.
Oh, thanks for that. Well, the cliffhanger at the end of the last Plus show was whether you were going to be alive by the end of the week.
Yeah. Well, I basically had what I thought was a heart attack on a flight back from Hawaii and went and got a whole heap of tests and everything sorted out, and they don't know.
That's great.
He's just like, everything could be fine, or you could drop dead in 5 minutes. Like, okay, that's great to know.
No, what did the doctor actually say?
Basically that from the scans that they've done, they shove you in an MRI, right? And then she goes to me, it was a CT scan, sorry. She goes, oh, you might feel a just slight sensation to urinate. My testicles felt like they were on fire. It was awful.
How long did that last?
Oh, it was only like 2 or 3 minutes as they ran the scan. But yeah, they can't find anything. But at the same time, they're saying, oh, we need to double check. So I'm not clear of the woods yet. But basically, they don't know.
You were telling me one doctor basically said to you, if there's a problem with this part of your valve or something, you'll be dead instantly.
Yeah, you'll be dead in 5 minutes.
And that's how he worded it.
Yeah.
Like great bed manner,
and I'm
bedside
like,
manner.
Should I be worried? He's like, oh, no. I'm like,
Let me check my chart to see if you will die.
Suspense. That's what it felt like.
Was it Dr. Chuti?
No, it wasn't Dr. Chuti, but yeah. So there's a little bit of apprehension going. A very nice guy, though. So hopefully I'm in good hands. But we'll find out.
You'll go to the afterlife. It'll be great.
Oh, great.
Out of all the people that would know about after death, it would be you. You've done hundreds of shows on the near-death experience. You've heard every story in the book.
Look, I'm hoping that it's just stress. I'm thinking it's stress. I'm hoping it's stress. The fact that a whole heap of scans haven't shown anything suggests it's stress, but we'll see how we go.
I hope the diagnosis is just really bad plane food.
That's a possibility. Well, see, they thought that I had a clot because I've been flying on international flights. And Straight away, it's like, I think you've got a clot. I'm like, oh, that's just great as well. That's so good to know.
Awesome.
So.
Well, we're ready and raring to go for this show.
We're here to do a show.
As you can tell.
Here we are.
Very, very excited. No, I am actually very excited to speak to Grant Cameron. He's going to join us on this episode to talk about one of his new books, which isn't really new because he was sitting on the manuscript for 37 years.
Oh.
He just had this stored away. And it's Charlie Red Star, True Reports of One of North America's Biggest UFO Sightings. This is an incredible flap that occurred over Carmen in Manitoba in 1975 and 1976. And he explains that this is a really strange year for UFO activity. You had the Travis Walton sighting in 1975. You had this huge flap in Manitoba. You had all the activity over nuclear facilities.
Yes, yeah.
In 1975 and 1976. And all of this ties together in this really strange flap. And when I was interviewing Grant, I actually interviewed him last week, and I realized pretty quickly I wouldn't be able to just play the interview as a whole thing.
Okay, why is that?
Just because of Grant's style of answering questions. Like, you give Grant a question and he's gone. He's just, he's off.
That's what you want.
He's off for like 40 minutes.
Oh, right, okay.
I just ask him one question and then you lose track of the question after about 20 minutes. You forget what you ask him. And after 30 minutes, you're deep into some CIA conspiracy. And ultimately, in a bizarre way, it leads us to this story of a alien princess from Pakistan who arrived in an alien pod in the 1980s. That's where we end up at the end of this episode.
An alien princess from Pakistan or arrived in Pakistan?
Arrived in Pakistan. Sorry to make that ultra confusing.
Okay.
I can't reveal anymore.
No, I won't go any further.
Did you put anything together for our Plus extension coming up?
Oh, you wouldn't even know what the day I've had. So because I have been freaked out and not paying attention, and I've had God knows how many things stuck into me, I picked up this great book. It's called Psychic Animals, A Fascinating Investigation of Paranormal Behaviour. It's by Dennis Bardens. And I read the whole thing, and you can see here I got all my tabs and all my notes.
It looks kind of familiar.
Yeah, it looks kind of familiar. Didn't really think about it. I'm like, oh my God, these stories are amazing. This is so good. Until about 5 minutes before we're about to record this afternoon, you go to me, we covered that book. We did that book back in December of last year.
Yeah. Pretty fresh. You are the human goldfish. You're like a weird goldfish mermaid. The rest of your body, actually, all of you is like a normal human being, but inside your brain,
I'm just
like
coming
it
apart,
functions like
then.
A goldfish brain.
You got to give me a break.
3 second memory.
So what I have done, though, is because I ordered a whole heap of books, so I went through the library, did a bit of shelf elfing, and unfortunately, Jenny Randles is back. So I've got Investigating the Truth Behind Men in Black, the Men in Black phenomenon, and I'm going to go into some strange, more unusual cases of Men in Black, not the standard intimidation, even though there is some of that. I want to go into cases where Men in Black invade your dreams or Men in Black cases that have happened globally rather than focusing on America. And there are even some cases that occurred well before the Bender case.
Okay.
So that suggests that these guys have been around for a long time, including Men in Black that showed up right after the Victorian flap of the strange airships of the early 1900s, late 1800s. So they've definitely been around for a while.
Oh, that sounds fun. Mm. There's a couple of MIB elements in this Manitoba story as well.
Oh, right.
Let's go right into it. This is Charlie Redstar from Grant Cameron. He writes in the opening that this book is the recounting of my work investigating the numerous unidentified flying object sightings that occurred in the Canadian province of Manitoba in 1975 and 76. As I said at the start, he's held this manuscript for 36 years. He says the Charlie Redstar story is a really unique tale. In terms of time and the number of sightings involved, it was one of the biggest UFO flaps to have ever occurred. And despite the number of sightings that occurred, not many people have heard of the flap, since almost none of the sightings were publicised beyond local TV, radio, or newspaper reports. And the Manitoba UFO flap was different from other historic ones in that the UFO became personified. It became a friendly nightly vision. Charlie Redstar. People gave it a name.
Oh, I see. Isn't that interesting?
He says this all started in February of 1975. Manitoba suddenly became the focus of a series of almost nightly UFO sightings that lasted nearly 2 years. Most of the activity was centered on the town of Carmen, and it also leaked out into surrounding towns and even into North Dakota and the United States as well. But the sightings would occur day after day. I mean, it was happening all the time throughout the summer in all types of weather. Definite patterns of time and place could be established, Grant writes, from the numerous reports that came in. In the first 8 nights I was in Carmen, he said, I had 6 sightings. The evidence seemed to indicate that at least in this situation, the phenomena could be isolated. So he notes in the introduction that if you look at most UFO activity over the years, it's usually been the case, well, UFO researchers come to the conclusion that you can't go looking for the UFOs. They have to find you.
Yeah.
You can't count on any predictable pattern in the activity.
No.
But he says these sightings over Manitoba, this so-called Charlie Redstar object that everyone was seeing, it was almost like clockwork. It had a regular path that was fairly predictable, and you could turn up in certain parts of the town, and on most nights of the week, there was a good chance you might see this strange object in the sky. And Grant writes that the sightings were so commonplace that TV crews would actually go out and try and capture this thing because they knew they had a fairly good chance. They'd have their cameras ready and everything running. One of the local TV stations had 4 sightings, but they were only able to document one of them. And this came from Martin Rugney, who was working for CKY TV. And this footage he caught became one of the most important UFO movies in the history of the phenomenon. It's quite amazing. And it's amazing that even back then with their equipment, they were able to catch anything at all.
Yeah.
And this is really what stirred on huge press coverage. This created a huge buzz. I mean, Grant says that this, for its age, for its day, really went viral. It hit all the press and just went everywhere. And Grant explains in this audio here that this is really what got him involved in UFOs. He was a young man at the time, and this is what attracted him to Carmen in Manitoba. He wanted to find out what's going on. Here's Grant. Let's take a listen.
42 years later, I start to think that this was intended. that I was intended to go out there, because we didn't, I would never have gone if it had not been for this event. And that was, there was a local TV station here that actually caught the thing on the ground. And as far as I know, this is the only case in ufology where this actually happened. And what happened was the object, there was all these TV crews who were going out there and they were trying to film this thing. And the night before they actually got the film, they had seen it, but they weren't able to get it on camera. So they went back to the TV studio and they said, you know, we almost got it and we want to go out again tomorrow night. And the assistant news producer said, this is absolute nonsense. I'm not paying any more overtime. You guys want to go, you can go on your own time. So what happened was there was a couple of the reporters and they grabbed a guy who was a film editor. He had never even shot a TV camera before in his life. And they went out, and this is this famous story where they surround this thing on the ground. And this film, you can actually see, there's a documentary called UFO Cover-Up Live, which was done in October of 1988, which you can view on YouTube. And they can see it down the road, and it's sort of glowing up, glowing down, glowing up, glowing down. And they leave the cameraman with the camera standing in the middle of this road, and they have these mile roads, if you're familiar with Canada. And they have a mile road going north-south, and then every mile there's a road, a dirt road, and going east and west the same thing, so you get this checkerboard pattern. So one of the crews, there was about 10 people, there's a bunch of pilots, so I think it was about four pilots that night. Some of them went on the north mile road, one went on the south mile road, and they went down to try to end up where they thought it was and come across and run into it. And the one on the north actually went down 8 miles and it came across, and this thing, they described this thing as sitting in a field. It was 50 feet in length, and it was like a drive-in movie screen. It was up on a 45-degree angle, tilted up into the sky.
So it wasn't actually making contact with the ground. It was kind of...
No, it was hovering. It was hovering. Okay. And then they were just floored. It was behind this set of trees. They were in the middle of nowhere because there's really no towns here. It's sort of remote. So they're looking around at all the various microwave towers to try to figure out their perspective as to where they were in the countryside. And when they look back, the thing was gone. And they thought it had disappeared. And meanwhile, it had actually just jumped up in the air. And the guy at the other end of the road, and this is where 42 years later, I'm starting to think, nah, I don't think this was chance. He's at the end of the end of the road, and he sees this thing glow up, glow back down, glow up, glow back down. And knowing that they had not gotten anything the night before, he said, I got to get something on camera here. So he said, well, the next time it glows up, I'm going to shoot. So it started to glow up and he shot, and this thing jumped up in the air almost as if the UFO said, are you ready? Get ready to shoot. And as he pushes the trigger, this thing jumps up in the air. And some of the estimates had it up 5,000 feet in three frames of film. So he got these 2 6-inch pieces of film, which went viral. NBC picked it up. Everybody was on this thing. And it basically showed what we had described and what people had seen. Was this object that didn't actually fly in a straight line. It was sort of bobbing up and down like it was flying on a wave. So when that film was taken, and there was a big thing in my city when this film was taken, they did an 8-minute documentary on it, and they slowed this frame down frame by frame as they went through this frame. Then I said to my friend Larry, I said, come on, let's go see what they're looking at.
So that's how you got wind of it, I see.
Yeah, so then we, in May, this is May of 12th or something like that, 1975, we went out there, and Larry and I and a third guy who was in the back seat, we drove into the town, out of the town, into the town, out of the town, and we were there for an hour. And then at the end of the hour, my friend Larry says, okay, we'll drive back in town one more time. If we don't see anything, we'll go home. I said, fantastic, this has been a total waste of time. So we make the turn. And we start back into the town, and the thing appears from the left to the right. Now, I always describe to people a very important principle in reality and in UFOs is there is believing and then there is knowing. So when this thing appeared from the left, nobody in the car said, oh, I wonder if that's what they're looking at. Is that what they're looking at? Everybody just went, there it is. Oh, yeah. And it was just like pandemonium in the car because it was just so bizarre.
Describe to us what you were saying.
It just mystified me that it didn't seem to be flying in a straight line. It was sort of bobbing up and down like a bobber on a fishing line. And it was red and it was glowing. It was like a plasma object, very, very sort of bright, but glowing very, very slowly. And very low, and as it went in front of the car and was heading, there was a bunch of school buses that were parked outside this town, and it was so low that I knew it was going to go in behind these school buses. So the car was actually not even really stopped yet, and I was getting out of the car to run through the ditch to go across the parking lot because I knew it would be behind these school buses. And I remember standing by these school buses and just watching this object just slowly pulse red as it pulsed off and just flew off into the northeast like it was just going for nothing. I mean, it was just burning gas. It didn't seem to be doing anything or going anywhere.
Right. And what was the speed that it was moving when you guys were seeing it?
Oh, very slow. I mean, there was one time I actually drove off the end of a road. And because this is this deal that they have these mile roads that go north and south. And then I learned the lesson that every eighth mile, they move the thing 50 feet because the world is round. So they always have to shift the road 50 feet. And so I was chasing this thing. You can actually gain on this thing. We'd actually be gaining on this thing, getting closer and closer. And all of a sudden, suddenly the car was in the air and I had a bunch of kids with me in the car. And I'm going, oh, my first thought was, we're being abducted. And the car was up in the air. And we landed. Luckily, there was a pile of snow in the field. Otherwise, the car would have been totally ruined.
Oh, no.
And we landed in this pile of snow. But it was moving very slow, and it always moved very slow. And it was always very, very close to the ground along the treetop level and stuff. That's what most people were reporting.
That was Grant's first sighting that he described it. And he went back the night after and saw it again. Like I said, that's how regular this activity was. And he described it there as a pulsing plasma-like object.
Mm.
But this really depended on the state that the object was in as to how people would describe it. They mostly described it as this red pulsing object. But oftentimes eyewitnesses would say, if you looked through this pulsing red, you would see a disc-shaped object.
Right, and you commonly hear that with UFO sightings, that there is some sort of light, but when you get closer to it, or if you use film equipment to zoom in on it, you can see that there is actually a craft there that seems to be surrounded by, I don't want to say ionizing radiation, but some type of
field.
Yeah, some type of field, exactly. But I found it fascinating there how he describes that when they were trying to film it, that it was almost intelligently communicating with them.
Yeah.
That's unusual.
Yeah, that it jumped up for the cameraman to say, here I am.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just another added element of this being more than, it's just simply a craft. Like, let's say that it is a extraterrestrial craft. The fact that it seems to be interacting with people suggests that it's more than just a nuts and bolts aircraft.
And I just left that bit in the end there where Grant was describing going in the air, launching himself off a Canadian road, trying to chase this thing. In my mind, I've got like a Chevy Chase.
Yeah, that's exactly what I came to.
Lampoon's Vacation with all these kids in the back, and Grant's just chasing this UFO flying through the air. Well, again, this glowing disc became known as Charlie Red Star. It was personified by the local people of Manitoba. And even local newspapers and radio stations, even though they started to report it as a UFO at first, eventually everyone just started calling it Charlie Red Star. And Grant explained to me that this came from one of the original witnesses just called it Charlie Red Star. They just, because that's what it looked like. It was a red star, pulsing red star.
Yep.
And they called it Charlie the Chief, because it was in reference to the native people in the area.
Right.
So it was the Chief Charlie, the Red Star. So this kind of stuck, and the whole community kind of got around it. It became this fun thing. So even general stores in the area, they would advertise signs saying things like, shop where Charlie shops. You know, it became this fun thing for the community. And Grant explains in the book that the sightings became so regular, and the path it ran on, it was reasonably regular. You would go to these meetup points and you would see all your old friends from the community.
So it's Pokemon before augmented reality came out.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah. It's hunting a UFO instead of Pokemon. And you would hang out with all these people and you'd, you know, drink some beers and have fun, and you'd wait for this crazy thing to appear in the sky. Now, they kind of built up this mythology around the object as well. They decided that Charlie lived in the west near Rosalie. It was said that he would stay in the hills during the day and he would fly into the valley at night. And the way that the object moved, where Grant describes it as kind of bobbing up and down in this slow, almost nonchalant fashion, it became known as the beer run.
The beer run?
Yeah, they just said Charlie was coming into town to pick up some beer and then he would disappear. They just cheekily called it the beer run.
They really are giving it a personality, a character though, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. It's really interesting how he became personified. But when the people of Miami and Carmen, these two towns that had most of the activity, when they attempted to chase Charlie in their cars, they learned pretty quickly that the object was far superior to everyone in knowledge and technology. They discovered that Charlie was able to dodge and tease them, was capable of disappearing at the first sign of a chase. And there's just so many sightings that are included here. In 1977, Grant says that according to the computer files at the Center for UFO Studies, there was 5,000 UFO reports from the Manitoba area over a decade.
Right.
So 5,000 sightings over 10 years. But in this period between 1975 and 1977, there was 4,000 sightings. So the activity was...
almost tenfold.
So prevalent.
Yeah.
And Grant explains here just how many people were having sightings and just how regular it was.
Usually every night there was something moving around. And here again, there was really no planes. Well, I did a poll at the high school, in the Carmen High School, and there was other towns around there. And it was also extended down into Minnesota and Wisconsin, although the publisher wanted some of the book cut. It was too long. So some of that stuff I cut out. It was so prevalent in Wisconsin, in one town in Wisconsin, that the CIA actually sent two agents to the town to find out what was going on, to watch this event. So it was not just in Manitoba. It was in sort of in a line through Minnesota, through Wisconsin, and also in Ontario. And I don't think it's even in the book. There was really bizarre stuff going on in Ontario, which is the province just east of us. And there was these, they were pulling these triangles out of the ground, and these were about 15 feet on a side, and the earth that was pulled out would be maybe a foot and a half deep. And just these entire triangles of earth that were lifted up and moved over and just stuck beside them. When I went back 35 years later, I was going to lecture in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, and I went back to talk to a guy by the name of Bob Diemer, who was the guy who ran the airport. And he was very famous because he had created the industry of rebuilding old World War II planes. So he had gotten a Japanese Zero and he pulled it out of the jungle, and he had rebuilt this Japanese Zero and sold it to the Canadian Aviation Museum. So he was a fairly famous guy here.
Right.
And he was the one that when I went back and I said, Bob, how many sightings did you have? And he said, oh, about 150. And I said, how many did you have after 1976? And he said, none. And it was like they took the drugs out of the water. So 1975, it was he had 175 sightings. And the same at the high school. When I polled the high school, and this high school had quite a few kids in it, 400 or 500 kids or whatever. When I polled the high school, I said, how many people have seen a UFO in the last 2 years? And it was way over 50%. I think it was like 59% or something like that. And there was more kids who said they'd seen a UFO than had seen a 747. And so and that was the national average. I was doing lectures around different schools, and the poll everywhere else showed 11%. And everywhere here, it was like very, very high.
So that gives you a sense of just how many people in the community were actually seeing this thing.
Hang on, whoa. What was with the dirt triangles?
Yeah, again, this is why I've kind of cut the interview up in this way, because Grant would just go off on a tangent and it'd take a long time to get him back.
Did I hear it correctly that just randomly triangles of dirt were being found around?
Well, that triangles of dirt would be lifted out of the ground and then placed next to where it had been cut out of. And this was happening all over the place. No one could figure out what was doing it. There were no tracks. There was no tire marks. Well, there was no evidence of how it was being done.
Isn't it
strange?
It's
like a weird crop circle.
I was
going to
say, yeah, it sounds like a crop circle without it being a crop circle. That's so peculiar. I mean, is it sampling something? Is it trying to collect ore? Like, why do that?
Well, that's what is so fascinating about this flap, is by the end of it, you just have so many questions. But that ultimate question of, why were the UFOs in this area and so concentrated in this particular amount of time? I think Grant actually answers this at the end. So we will find out what was going on. But let me just hit you with some of the sightings that were reported. There's so much in this book, and Grant, you know, repeats multiple times that he had to scale it back for the publisher.
Yeah.
But let me just hit some of these details. So there's sightings from Constable Ian Nicholson from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. He described seeing an oval-shaped light. There was a white X-shaped halo around it, but not connected to it. He said the red was the color of a traffic safety light, a stoplight. He said it was a big red ball coming right at us. Anthony Britton and his wife said it was like a big landing light, and it was loafing along. It was close enough that you could actually see the dome on top, but it was all pulsing red. Jeanette Frost of Sperling said it was as red as could be. It was just going up and down as these things go in this weird bobbing motion. And this is what most eyewitnesses reported, that this object would be skipping, like bobbing up and down, almost like a fishing thing.
Yeah.
Just bobbing up and down. Jeanette said it was so stupid, it seemed that it would even wobble from side to side. It was really an odd looking thing, but it was as red as could be. this was definitely a disc-shaped sort of thing. And then Travis Taylor said it was quite low to the ground. It was a huge saucer-shaped sort of thing. It was glowing red, like I suppose metal would be when it's hot. Yeah, these sightings continue throughout, and you start to hear details. It's interesting, the eyewitnesses mostly report the same dimensions. They mostly report the same characteristics of the craft, the same colors. But then we get to the McCann family, and it was interesting because it seemed as though, I wouldn't say the activity was centered around them, but they certainly had a wider experience, a more varied experience than most people in the town would have. They saw all sorts of things, experienced all sorts of things related to these objects.
Do you think there's a reason for that?
Well, one thing that stood out to me is that they had a lot of horses on their property, and there seemed to be an interest in the horses from the objects. Now, Grant here speaks briefly about the McCann family and describes the terrible treatment they received from the rest of the community. They were certainly ostracized by their experiences. And it seems strange at first when you hear that because everyone was seeing this thing.
Everyone's excited about it by the sounds of it.
But they kind of crossed a line when something serious happened to their horses. And it's almost like what they described crossed some kind of unspoken taboo. Well, let's take a listen.
Nobody wanted to be identified, basically because of this McCann family. They had such bizarre encounters with this thing that nobody wanted to be related because they knew what had happened to this family. This family was totally ostracized in the town. They had an incident where they were raising PMU horses that were used for birth control pills and stuff like that. They had this big operation going, and they had a field that was maybe, I guess it'd be 20 miles north of where they lived. And they lost 32 horses. These horses just disappeared. And so, of course, he attributed this to the UFOs because he'd seen the UFO in the field during the day at one point, hovering in the field. And so once he made that public, and that was it for the family. It was sort of like, there's no way we're going to get associated. And the one kid once told me that they were in school. They would say, "What happened to your horses? Did they go to the Big Dipper for a drink?" And right. And these kids, like, and I met the one kid. I went back when I was doing the book, and I was getting a picture. I wanted to get a picture of this famous barn that they had in the back. So I'm taking pictures around the farm, and suddenly this truck comes racing across the field, and this kid says, "What are you doing?" And very confrontational. And I said, "Well, you know," I explained who I was, and the family that used to live here had these UFO sightings, and I was involved. And he said, "Oh," he said, "That's my parents." And I said, you know, so I started talking to him, and he was only 1 year old. I remember he was in a crib when this thing was going on. And he said even he, when he grew up, was totally ridiculed by kids. And he wasn't even involved. He was only 1 year old when this thing happened.
Such a shame.
But this family had, like, for example, they claimed there was hydro was being taken off their line. They had these bills of $700 a month, which was huge at that time. And they had this thing had landed in the backyard. And they described these beings walking around outside this craft. They couldn't really see the beings, but they could see shadows of something moving around underneath the craft. And then they had the one where it landed, and they had these horses rode all be hitched up inside this big giant barn. And the wife said when it landed, the horses went crazy. They thought they were going to take the barn down. And then they said it just suddenly went silent, and everything was silent, and the horses were silent, and this object was in the backyard. So they had these things coming right over the house, very low, triangles following the car home, just so many bizarre stories. And the wife told me that she would go to this is like a town of 2,000 people, yeah, very small post office, that she would go in the post office. And people would walk in and see her and actually just turn around and go out the other door, that nobody even wanted to talk to her. But the McCann family was big, and that was one of the big stories. The other really big story was the landing of this object that was filmed. And the other one, the most riveting story that affected me in the area was this young 7-year-old boy who they had no indoor plumbing. So he was actually urinating off the porch. Mm. And his parents weren't home. And this was a kid who his mother believed this was the devil, and she would not allow this kid to be interviewed. He was very shaken up. He had nosebleeds. He had been taken out of school and stuff like this, very much affected by this object. She said, "No, he's not. Nobody's going to talk to him." And the father was determined he was going to find out what was going on. And so they brought me in secretly on a Wednesday night when the mother was out at church or somewhere. And I remember going into the room with a friend of mine, and it was a riveting experience because this kid was only 7 years old. He was very small, and he was hiding behind a chair on the other side of the room. And his father said, "Okay, you tell Mr. Cameron. Tell Mr. Cameron what you saw." And the kid just was peering out from behind this chair. And the kid was so scared that he'd actually taken a gun. He had taken a rifle. He'd never shot the rifle before in his life. He was so scared he was going to shoot this thing. But he was standing on urinating off this porch of this house, and this object appeared over a tree, which was about 50 yards away from where he was. And it was right on top of the tree, and he could hear branches breaking on the tree.
Wow.
And it was there, and then it had moved over the road, and then it had just disappeared. So his father tells me the whole story and the fear, and he was trying to get his sister and the fact that the parents weren't home and stuff. And he had a little horse that was called Sonny, and this horse was with him when this happened, and the horse just looked up at this object and raced into it. He had his own little shed where they kept the horse, and he ran into a shed. And so when the father had finished telling me the story, I remember this kid was still hiding behind the chair. And I got on my knees and I went into the middle of the room, and I had a piece of paper that had all sorts of different UFO shapes on it. And I put it on the floor and I said, "Can you tell me what it looked like?" And then he peered out and he sort of crawled out from behind the chair, and he took one look at the paper that I had. And he pointed quite quickly to a classic saucer with a sort of a dome on it. And he said, "That one." And then I said, "Was it big?" And he went, "Big as a house." And I said, "Did it have lights on it?" "Oh, lights all over it." And then I said, "Was it scary?" "Oh, yeah." And then I said, "What color lights?" "All different colors. Then they turned white." And I said, did your dad said it flew onto the road?" "Yeah." And I said, "Did it fly away or did it disappear like a light?" "Out like a light." He was just whispering, the fear in this kid's face, it was just like, wow, it's just a riveting story that anybody can say whatever they want about, you know, people making this stuff up. There was no doubt this kid was absolutely terrified by what he had seen. And I wanted to go back later to see whether this kid had been abducted, because he had all the classic signs of being abducted. But then I figured, no, he may have followed in his mother's footsteps and figured this was demonic or whatever. And I figured I'd leave this kid alone. But there was these kind of stories of people. There was even stories, I don't know if we put them in the book, there was even stories, because as you said, there was all these people in the back 40 of these roads. And a lot of kids, what they would do is, and maybe they still do it, is they'd get a case of beer and go and sit in the middle of the country and sit on a side road and drink beer. So we were running into all these kids, and there was actually one where two were making out, and they actually told me that they were making out in the back seat, and this thing appeared over the back of the car. So there was a lot of these weird stories of people. And I would say that I probably only got a fraction of the stories of what actually happened.
It's interesting just there with the kid at the end, you know, clearly being terrified. And Grant said that he wanted to go back years later because the kid had all the signs of an alien abduction. Well, it's important to note that while Grant was doing all this research back in 1975, he was in his early 20s. He had just started to look into the UFO phenomenon. This is really what got him interested. And the idea of abductions wasn't really out there.
No, I mean, especially back in the 70s, when you're sort of getting into it, abductions didn't really take off from the dark side until about the mid-1980s.
Yeah, well, Communion came out in 1989, and then it was, you know, in the mainstream. But Travis Walton's experience was 1975, but, you know, that wouldn't
not
have been
well publicized
until years later.
Mm.
So just the possibility that this was happening to the eyewitnesses wasn't necessarily in anyone's minds at the time. So as I was reading through this, I kept on wondering, because there's all these stories of people being pursued by objects as well. And eventually in 1976, the sightings shift to a lot of triangles. There's a lot of triangles showing up.
Really?
That are pursuing people in their cars. And yeah, the whole time I'm just wondering, oh, I wonder how many people got snatched and we just never heard of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe they don't even recall it, right? I wonder if a reason why more people come forward recalling abductions now is because it's out there. It's kind of, it's part of popular culture that people go, oh, maybe I should go and get a regression or find out what happened.
And with the McCanns and their horses going missing, I mean, that was really strange as well. They reported the theft or the disappearance to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, And they found no evidence of broken fences. There was no evidence of tire tracks. The only tire tracks they found were from the McCann's vehicles. So there was accusations of fraud as well, that he had just sold the horses and reported them as stolen. But he didn't.
Why then, though? But why? I mean, if you're going to do that, why would you do it?
Well, insurance fraud.
No, but what I'm saying is, though, I mean, you can commit insurance fraud at any time, right? You shouldn't, but people can. Why would they do it in the middle of a UFO flap where their property is being harassed by strange lights and craft?
Yeah, well, the main comeback against that was that he didn't have insurance on the horses.
Oh, so there you go.
It was just a straight up loss. The only thing he could do was write the loss off on his taxes, and that was it.
Something grabbed me that he mentioned there about the horses being used for birth control or something.
Yeah.
That's kind of strange, especially with, you know, the claims of hybridization and everything else. Was there something about, I'm just speculating, but maybe there's something about those horses that fascinated the extraterrestrials.
I don't know. I had no idea they used horses
for
birth control.
No, neither did I. But I guess they used to use I can't remember what it was for.
You're
I
think
just
it was getting insulin. The hormones, right?
Yeah, they used to produce insulin in certain organs. So I don't know, maybe.
Getting some of that horse juice.
Yeah, gross.
Yeah, that is gross. That's what most of those products are like that.
Yeah, that's true. There's a few things also there in that audio that just caught my attention for a moment. One was that something landed and there were beings that were seen, shadowy beings walking around it. Does he describe what they actually look like, or is that as far as we get?
Well, when you actually go into the sighting reports, it's a little bit confusing because the McCanns change their story and say, actually, no, we didn't see beings. It was probably just the lights bouncing off the shadows.
Okay.
So they're not entirely sure. But there are reports later on of diminutive little guys that are seen.
Right.
Okay. And the whole time I was reading this book and reading all these sightings, that was the question in my mind is, when are the little guys going to show up? When are we going to start seeing them? And they do eventually appear. But I just wanted to mention one story because at the end, he's mentioning young people going out and partying and all kinds of sightings and new objects are being seen as this phenomenon continues. And there was this incredible sighting that took place on May the 16th in 1975 at Steffenfield Dam. It's 3 miles west from where the TV crew caught the footage of that object. And it was an early Sunday morning, so the party was going all night, Saturday night, and it was really dragging on. But where they were having the party was at Steffenfield Dam Reservoir, and at about 2 a.m., 5 men got bored of the party, so they left and they walked over to the dam. This was on the south side of the reservoir. And they're standing on the dock overlooking the water, and suddenly, here it is. Charlie Red Star, this huge red glowing object, the size of a full moon, appears over the dam. It's about 100 feet away from the dock. And it's just hovering there, motionless, no sound, not doing anything. And then it shoots a beam of light, bright white light, down into the reservoir between these two boys. And the beam is shining down through the water for a few seconds. And the 5 men notice that this smaller white object, it's about 6 feet by 10 feet across, starts to form where the beam had touched the water. This is, again, about 100 feet from the shore. And this glowing white object beneath the surface starts moving towards them. And it's kind of like Jaws. They can see the ripples of the water as this white orb under the water is floating towards them, like moving towards them at speed.
Sounds like some kind of probe or something.
Well, this thing is extremely luminous. It's lighting up the entire reservoir. They can actually see the bottom of the reservoir. This thing's producing so much light. And the waves, the ripples from the water, as this thing is increasing in speed, it's come within 15 feet of the dock. And one of the guys, in this moment of desperation, he picks up a rock and he hurls it at this object, just thinking, I've got to do something. And amazingly, he hits it. Now, as the rock hits the object, it immediately splits into 4 pieces, 4 perfect pieces that then assemble themselves in a straight line.
What, like 4 orbs or just 4?
Well, yeah, 4 pieces of this orb. So I guess they're 4 orbs. And these pieces, almost like a conveyor belt, they start rotating themselves back towards where they first started. It's really strange,
strange.
The way it splits out. And it goes back to where the object had first appeared. And It slowly disappears. Then this main glowing red object splits into two pieces and they bob off in separate directions.
That is so strange.
And you start to see this in these sightings where it starts to differentiate from what was just first this glowing red object, disc-shaped, to people seeing, now they're seeing mini flying saucers, like small disc-shaped objects. They're seeing these odd metal spheres floating around. Triangles start showing up in 1976. Some people reporting seeing floating Ferris wheels. All sorts of strange stuff is going on. And I wanted to play some audio of Grant's own experience where he was pursuing one of these objects. And he told me that he nearly jumped on it. And I mean that literally. Grant Cameron nearly jumped on a UFO.
But it was small? Or?
Let's take a listen.
All right.
So the one night we're about 11 miles east of the town of Carmen, and we're sitting on the corner, a road that goes around this town. And we're waiting for this thing to appear, and the guy's got his super-duper cameras or whatever, and nothing really appears, because a lot of times they come just after dusk. So we're standing on this big road, the main highway, and all of a sudden I looked around and I said, Jim, there's all these orange lights. What are these orange lights? And it looked like farm lights, which are white, and these were like orange as oranges. They were just like totally orange, and I'm going, this is weird. So we went down this side road, and then one of these mile roads going towards the United States, and I had an 8mm movie camera, and he had the binoculars, and he wasn't using his camera at the time, but he had the binoculars, had the 8mm movie camera. So we turn on this mile road, which goes, as you know, all the way down to the United States. It's straight as can be, so there's no turns on it or anything like that. And we look in this orange light is sitting in the middle of the road, and you really can't, you know, it looks like it's, you know, like a ball, maybe, you know, size of a desk or something that's down the road. So we drive down where we think it is, and it's still the same distance. And so we drive the same distance again, and we come to the end of the first mile road, and they're burning garbage in the town dump.
Oh.
And look on the road and the orange thing is still sitting in the road. And now the garbage dump is beside us. So then we go again, another mile road and another mile road, and we go down 8 mile roads. And this thing is still, it's in the same spot. And we know, like, there's no way this thing can still be in the same. It's got to be moving. It's got to be moving according to the way we move the car. And then we came across, this is April, I think April 1st of 1976, and all the snow had melted. And what had happened was all you had was the road and then maybe 2 inches of water in the field. So it looked like a giant lake with a road going through it. And there was a drainage ditch where they would drain the water off these fields. And it was a wooden bridge that went over this sort of a drainage ditch. And now we could actually see it. We were driving up to the car and we could see this thing was sitting on the bridge. Now I could actually have perspective because there's something behind it. And I said, Jim, sitting on the bridge. Let's go. And so we went up on the bridge and then it was gone. And now it was no longer in front of us. We couldn't see it anymore. So I said, it's got to be under the bridge. So we were looking under the bridge. We're trying to look, but the water was so high and they had these big snow drifts along the side of the river type thing where it was that we couldn't really see under it. So then we continue down the bridge, go down the other side, and we're heading towards the United States border. And I look back and now it's behind us and it's sitting on the bridge again. And I said, come on, this time let's walk. Let's not take the car. It's going to take off. So let's walk. And I remember this, I would take 7 steps, shoot 3 seconds of film, take 7 steps, 3 seconds of film on this 8mm movie camera, 7 steps, 3 seconds of film. And it kept going. We're getting closer and closer and closer. And then we were actually at the bottom of the bridge. And all I had to do is run up the incline of the bridge. And it was right there. And the weird thing, it was a very peculiar type of light, which we called dead light. Now people have other names for it, but it was very distinctive because even though it was so bright that you really couldn't look at it in the binoculars, it wasn't lighting up the bridge. And it was like 2 inches from the edge of this wooden railing on the bridge. And all it was doing is casting this sort of orange glow on the bridge. And so we called it a dead light. Like it was all contained in within the ball. Very, very bright, but it wasn't lighting up. I thought it would have lit up the whole countryside, but it didn't.
Yeah, we've heard this before from other eyewitnesses that the light doesn't behave like normal light. Yeah.
Yeah, it was very, very bizarre. Almost like you hear people describing in the ship where the light is in a room and the light is actually breaks off. And it's not coming out of the room. It's almost like it's like an actual physical thing. So I was looking at this thing and I can still remember to today. I'm going, wow, why is it not lighting up the bridge? This is the most bizarre light I've ever seen. And so I said to my friend, I said, Jim, hold the camera. I'm going to jump on it. And it was almost the idea of Thomas the Doubter in the Bible. He went to feel Jesus' wounds and stuff. And I knew that story in my head. And there's a famous story in Manitoba, on the other side of the city, this famous story of the Mikulak story, where this guy and the U.S. Air Force investigated this case, where the thing lands and he's prospecting, and there's the door opens, and then he's yelling and he's all these different languages and stuff, and he goes to see who's in this craft, and he sticks his head in the craft and you can see these lights and stuff in the craft and hears these voices, and he puts his hand on the craft and suddenly the thing takes off and burns him. And it's a famous case where he goes to the Mayo Clinic and all this stuff. So I knew when I was going to jump on this thing, I said, there's a good chance I'm going to get burned, but I have got to touch this thing, because it kept disappearing. So I said, hold the camera, Jim, I'm gonna jump on it. So I'm just about to run, and he said, hang on, I think there's one sitting on top of the car.
Oh.
And I'm like, what? And so then I took the binoculars and I looked back, and the car was about a quarter of a mile away, maybe less than that. And I looked, and it looked like the sun, because we're looking into the north, and it looked like the sun coming up into the north. Like, it was this orange half sphere over top of the car and this orange smoke hanging down the side of the car. And I'm going, it's sitting right on top of the car. And I started to run. And as soon as I took about five steps, I go, oh no. And I, sure enough, I looked back. And of course, the one at the bridge is gone.
Oh,
and
no.
So we get back to the car, and then as we were running, it had moved onto the front hood. Then it looked like the inside of the car was on fire, because it was this orange reddish thing sitting on the hood, and you could see it through the back window and through the front window. And when we got back to the car, it wasn't there. And I remember, this is like, I mean, I'm a new guy. I'm, you know, not scientifically minded or whatever. I don't know what to do. I put my hand on top of the cars. Later on, he told me he was looking inside the car, because he was sure that the keys were gone, that somebody had taken the keys. And then I looked back and I said, Jim, it's back at the bridge. Come on, let's go. I want to jump on this thing. And he said, no, I don't want to go back. And I said, come on, we got close. I said, I want to jump on this thing. I want to touch it. And he said, no, I don't want it. And it was his car. And so what could I do? So we got in the car and we drove home. I couldn't believe it. And then 20 years later, it was the only case I've ever seen where people who were actually in the incident actually change, where they suddenly become disbelievers. Because 20 years later, I run into him at the main library in Winnipeg, and he said, you know, what are you doing? I said, I'm getting books. And he's coming out. And I said, so how's it going? He said, you still into that UFO stuff? And I said, oh, yeah, I'm still doing that. And he said, oh, you always were the gullible kind. And I went,
what?
And I swore at him. And I said, what? Are you kidding me?
That is insane.
I don't want to go back. And I said, you were there. you were so scared. We had to go home. I was just furious. I couldn't believe it, because that's the only time it ever happened. Like, I can understand if you haven't seen anything, you would, you know, say that. But he was the guy that didn't want to go back.
I wanted to include that story because I thought it was pretty funny that he was trying to jump on the UFO.
Oh, yeah, that's an amazing story. But in that case, just the end there, I mean, that's fear and denial. For him to have actually experienced something and then start projecting onto someone else saying that, oh, you're gullible, it's fear and denial. I mean, it definitely makes me think that they did see something very strange that night.
Maybe he has a false memory of the event that came from the fear. I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you, but
that's a possibility.
If enough time has passed, you know, you can remember things completely differently to how they happened.
Isn't it strange, though, the way he described the light coming off that thing? Yet again, it's not casting light onto anything else, but it's lit up itself. It suggests to you that, well, it suggests that we're dealing with something which is not of earthly physics.
Yeah, we hear that all time and time again. And another thing we often hear is the fear that's induced into the eyewitness in a UFO sighting, but often in any kind of paranormal experience. And it's not the fear that I'm describing, where you know that something is not right or there's something strange going on. It's something different to that. It's almost like it's an induced fear. It's used as a weapon of sorts.
It's like the sympathetic nervous system is activated. I don't know if it's infrasound or something that's beyond our understanding, but it's absolutely induced as some type of defense mechanism.
Yes, there's some kind of switch that's flicked that turns on this specific type of fear.
But doesn't it, I guess for me, it certainly terrifies me, because it means that on some level they understand our physiology that well, that they know how to manipulate us with unseen forces, which makes me just think that we're completely powerless with this phenomenon. No matter what they are or why they're here, we know that they've been here for a long time, or at least interacting with Earth for a long time. We're powerless against them.
Well, I might have a counterpoint to that, but let's hear from Grant Cameron, because he describes how the activity kind of shifted to a lot of triangle sightings in 1976. And he said that he could often go out with a torch and he would get responses from these objects, and he would chase them in the car and, you know, take a bunch of kids with him, and it was fun. You know, they would do a bunch of movements with the torch and the object would follow, until one night they seemed to set something off that they shouldn't have. Let's take a listen.
And I remember we were driving, and the kid who ended up being one of the assistants to the mayor of Winnipeg, which is a big city, he was in the front seat. He's taking notes. There's these kids in the back seat, and we're tracking these UFOs. They're all over the place, and this kid's keeping notes of this triangle's going this direction and stuff. And suddenly, and we're in a different spot, and suddenly I say, "Oh man, there's some of these ground lights. Come on, let's stop. I'll show you." And so I would take the first kid out of the car one at a time. And I would take him, and this thing was sitting there down this road. And I would take the flashlight side to side, and the thing would float like a leaf back and forth across the road like a leaf. I'd take it up and down, it would go up and down. I'd flash it, and the kid was going, "Oh, that's just cool." And then I'd say, "Okay, let me get your brother." And then I'd take him back, and I took the brother out. And that's when I flashed it three times at this object. And it made this whistling, beeping noise. And you were talking about the fact that it was very, very sort of entertaining. Like, we were chasing these things down the road and stuff. And it was a lot of fun. And at this moment, that all changed. I'm flashing the light at this thing, and it made this, what I describe as like a Morse code, but it's a whistling, beeping noise, And I'm going, "Oh my goodness, there's nothing in this thing." And I go, "Oh, we must've got the big one upset. They must be like, this thing's a monitor. It was tracking, and we got it upset. And now it's making this noise." And I look up on the American border, and there's this huge arc welding light on the American border. And I can tell you, if you describe people who've seen UFO sightings, it was the scariest moment of my life, when this thing it was chasing us, and this thing came around. It made this big, huge arc, and I'm going, no, don't turn, don't turn, don't turn. And I'm going, "Oh no, I could see it on the side of my eye." And the kid said that it actually shot a blue beam of light down on top of these objects on the road, and it made the turn. And I remember I was just petrified, and I said to the kids, "Give me my binoculars." And I remember taking the binoculars and holding them against the inside of the glass of this car, and because my hands were shaking so bad. And I looked up at this thing, and I remember the kids are in the back seat, and they're jumping around, and they're all excited, and it was coming right down the road, real low, right down, and it came right and sat right on top of the car. And in the field of vision, when I looked up in the binoculars, it was the entire field of vision. So it was either very, very big, or very, very close. And it looked like lights that were maybe 5 or 10 feet across. And I couldn't tell whether there was anything in between, or there was three. I think it was lights on an object. And it sat there. And then I remember it just made like, people will describe this in UFO encounters, where it looks like they cut the film, and there was just a slight jerk in the object. And as soon as it made that jerk, it was like, boom. The fear was instantly gone. It was like gone. There was nothing there. It was the most riveting fear I've ever had in my life. There's nothing even came close to this thing. And it was just bizarre how it, as soon as that film thing, where it made that slight jerk, it just went away. It was like unbelievable. It was weird.
Isn't that interesting? That slight adjustment from the craft and the fear he's experiencing suddenly vanishes.
Mm. I just don't know what to make of it. Again, it suggests that they can control us. They know exactly what they're doing. They know how to show themselves just enough, but then leave enough for us to question what the hell's going on.
Well, I was actually questioning that, because I used to think that as well. But after we did the Plus show on Tuesday, and I covered the case of this lost Samoan pyramid.
Yeah.
That was a fun story. But there was a couple of elements from that story where people who had climbed the pyramid reported the same thing, that all of a sudden they were overcome by this intense fear that seemed to come from nowhere.
And they were plagued by nightmares afterwards.
Yeah, it was controlling them. And when a scientist did ground-penetrating radar studies and magnetic studies on this ancient Samoan artifact, this Samoan pyramid, they discovered that it was a magnetic anomaly, that there was something off in the whole, you know, magnetics of the site. And it made me wonder if this fear, this feeling that people get from these craft, is just some kind of natural human response to a magnetic anomaly that is associated with the craft.
Yeah, I mean, that's a possibility. So maybe the craft is using some type of magnetic propulsion or something to avoid our gravity or whatever else. That's how it's able to fly. And that could be a possibility that, yeah, it's a side effect of that. But then at the same time, it just seems, it's so odd. It's almost like it's a real paradox, because especially when we're talking about that family, it seems like they were joyous about interacting with this thing. It seems like the town is loving it, that they're giving it a name and a personality and they're interacting with it. And yet there's still this underlying weird, sinister tone to it.
Yeah.
And there's paradoxical.
There's definitely that connection between the eyewitnesses and the object. I mean, even the reporters and the crews for the TV stations were reporting these kinds of things. That when they would, they noticed, because they went out there so many times to try and capture it, they noticed that when they went to press the button for the shutter, the object would just slightly move. So that every shot they get is blurry and unusable. It's almost as if it was, it was reading their actions, reading their mind. Except there was one photographer who consistently got good shots. Her name was Tanis Major. She was actually a professional photographer, but she said to Grant, wherever you go to film it, she said, make sure that there's a piece of glass between you and the object. And he thought, oh, wait, you're being serious? That sounds nuts. But she said, I swear, there's something about being behind the glass that stops them from messing up your photos.
I wonder why. So how would glass make a difference?
She seemed to think, she didn't exactly know how it worked, but she seemed to think it had something to do with stopping the object from reading her mind. But she consistently got good shots. She would sit inside the car and shoot through the windshield. And anytime you would leave the car, the object would move or it would, dash away or it would go out of distance. But you also had the typical reports of film not developing, of cameras suddenly losing batteries, of film just being blank when it was developed. All this kind of stuff was happening as well.
But she didn't experience any of that.
Well, she experienced that as well. But right. The only time she got good photos is when she was behind some kind of glass.
For a second I think, well, is it possible that maybe there's something in the silica that, but come on, it's evidently a UFO that can, do whatever it wants. How is it that a little bit of silicon would stop it?
It sounds nuts, right? Yeah. So she was even experimenting, and other photographers were experimenting with, when they're trying to take photos, to not think that you're taking a photo.
reading your mind.
Yeah, you're trying to fool it.
Yeah.
You're thinking about what you're going to make for dinner tonight while you're pretending to take a photo.
I bet that didn't work.
No, that never worked. Yeah. But there are also cases where, when good photos were taken, they were sent to this photographics expert for analysis, and he was claiming that his mail was being tampered with. Even when pictures were separated and mailed in separate envelopes from different mailboxes, none of them would reach him. They would get intercepted or they would just never arrive.
Suggesting almost Men in Black interference.
Well, one time his house was broken into, and he claims that his house was searched almost professionally, like methodically and meticulously gone through, but nothing was taken. And he was told by neighbors that they saw four conservatively dressed men were seen in front of the house during the 1.5 hours he was gone.
Interesting. It's intimidation.
Conservatively dressed men.
Which show up all
suits
the time.
Suits in black, maybe?
Yeah, after reading this book today, actually, or this afternoon, it suggests to me that I don't think that they're human. I don't think that there's something more to it than it just being...
They're not just conservatively dressed men.
No, I think... And it also, it's funny because it seems like they kind of change their clothing but always remain conservatively dressed, but they also don't know exactly what's going on. Like a small little case was where a couple of men in black showed up, and they showed up at this barn and they didn't know how to work the handle on the door of the barn. They didn't know what to do. It's like looking at it and fiddling with it and playing. And they didn't realize that you had to push it down to lift it up. And the people that were watching from the farmhouse were just shocked at these conservatively dressed, strange looking men.
Who can't open a door.
But were trying to get hold of UFO debris.
So what does all this mean? We've had 2 years of one of the biggest UFO flaps the world's ever seen. Hundreds of people are eyewitnesses, thousands of sightings, all sorts of activities going on. You've got horses going missing. You've got possible abduction accounts. You've got diminutive beings being spotted, which I don't have time to go into, but it's a few cases of entities being seen outside of landed craft. So what is it all for? What's the point? Well, Cameron says that when he returned to Carmen in 2004, this is almost 30 years after the flap, he expected everyone would be willing to talk about the UFO flap, to give their insights after 30 years and talk about how it changed their lives. But he said, bizarrely, no one really wanted to talk about it. Only Anthony Britton, who owned the local airfield, seemed eager to reflect on what had occurred. And Grant asked him why the UFOs had been in Carmen. And Britton said, you know why they were here. And Grant said, no, I don't know. Tell me. He said, I told you about it. And Grant said, Anthony, in 30 years, I've never known why they were here. And he immediately said, the missiles. I told you we'd sit in the hills and watch the objects coming in from the United States. And Grant said, as soon as he heard the word missiles, he knew this guy was right. And by 2004, researchers had become aware of the nuclear connection, and it all made sense for Grant. So he goes into this in detail in the later chapters, and it really is striking how this all falls into place. See, just over the border is North Dakota, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in 1975, North Dakota had as many as 300 ICBMs in the military bases there.
Nuclear-armed ICBMs?
Yeah, 3 nuclear warheads per missile.
Right.
In these massive silos. And that meant that if North Dakota was a country in 1975, just hypothetically, if it was a country, it would have been a nuclear superpower.
Wow.
So Grant lays out the timeline of how all this happened. Basically, there was an agreement between the Soviet Union and the United States. They had this idea that each country could build missile defenses and you would be able to shoot out of the air the other country's ICBMs.
Okay.
They just had this agreement that you'd be able to do that. And the United States chose North Dakota and as the area where they'd build these defenses. So they had all these missiles going into these bases in North Dakota, hundreds and hundreds of them. And all of these were going in and being activated in 1975, just as the activity started.
Oh, that's weird.
So, I mean,
it's a very weird coincidence. And of course, yeah, we know all of that history now of Minuteman missiles being activated, turned on, turned off by sources hovering over the top of them, sources firing lasers into them. It's very strange.
Yeah, it's got to be more than a coincidence. And so he's basically saying that you could almost trace this path of where the UFO activity was starting in Manitoba and making its way to these bases in North Dakota, doing whatever they need to do, keeping an eye on the nukes, and then making their way back. And not really caring what anyone in these little towns in Manitoba are seeing, having all this weird activity along the way. But there's a clear link between this activity and all these nukes going online in North Dakota. And it's odd because eventually this plan of being able to shoot, you know, the Soviets' missiles out of the air.
Is this part of the Star Wars program? Or is this
it was. Yeah, right, it's all okay. Part of that. But all of this was kind of moved aside for mutual assured destruction.
Right, okay.
That was the plan moving forward. So in February...
Well, that's not better. That's a lot worse.
Well, in February of 1976, they started decommissioning these sites. They started removing the nukes. They started, tearing down the bases. They didn't need them anymore.
Decommissioning them.
And that's when the UFO activity stopped.
Again. Okay. Yeah, that's more than a coincidence.
Grant says the records show they left and never returned. He said the UFO flap in Carmen was over. Charlie Red Star appeared to have left for good, and the citizens of Carmen returned to their normal lives. Grant said, I, on the other hand, fell down the UFO rabbit hole and have been chasing the mystery ever since. Now, this is where the interview got weird. Because Grant, like he had done for the last, hour and a half, was he went off on a tangent, but he started using this term consciousness download. And I had to kind of pull him up and say, well, what do you mean you got this consciousness download? Explain to me what this was. Because he was about to go off in a completely different direction. So I needed him to explain what this consciousness download was, how he got it, and what it revealed to him. Let's take a listen.
And I'm watching Colin Andrews, the famous crop circle guy, give a lecture in Phoenix, Arizona. And I'm sitting there watching him, and I don't want to be there. I'm not interested in crop circles. I'm in the room. And so I'm sitting there and I'm sort of zoning out. I'm like meditating, zoning out, not really paying attention. And all of a sudden, three pieces of a puzzle get stuck in my head. And it puts the pieces together and it said, this is how it works. This is the answer that I was looking for in 1975. What's this all about? What is this? And what it basically was this is all non-local consciousness. And the one was that top secret document. It stuck the top secret document in my head. The very next line, I was always quoting the first four lines. And the line that said, we were also talking with American officials and other things might be associated with flying saucers, such as mental phenomena. So this document was there. Then it put in a piece. We were chasing Dr. Eric Walker, who's former president of Penn State University. And we were asking about MJ-12. What about MJ-12? Is it still a 12 people, is it still all Americans? And he said, let me ask you a question. What do you know about ESP? And the guy was like, didn't have anything to do with anything until when I had that download, suddenly I realized what he was talking about. And the guy said, well, I really don't know. And he said, well, unless you understand about ESP and how it works, you will not be taken in by the control group. Very few people understand how this works. And then the third one was Ben Rich's famous speech in 1993. The third piece of the puzzle it put together was Ben Rich was asked, how do they get here? How does the propulsion system work? And he told Jan Hartson, the international director of MUFON, he said, let me ask you a question. What do you know about ESP? And Jan Hartson said, oh, it means everything in time and space is connected. And he said, that's how it works. And that is how it works. It's non-local consciousness. The CIA calls it phenomenology. It's all connected. Remote viewing, psychic phenomena. It's all the same thing. It's this non-local consciousness. And they are moving out of this and into the physical world. They can go back again. And that was the answer. And once I had the download of the consciousness of this fact that this is all together and came with absolute certainty, you don't have to check this. You don't have, I knew for a fact that this was the answer when this happened. And then it was like I put on glasses, I could read the street signs, and then everything, all the synchronicity started, and everything started to come together, and I started running into people who'd fly on the flying saucer, and I'd say, how do you fly a flying saucer? And they'd say, you do it with your mind. The craft is alive. You interact, you become one with the craft, you fly the craft at 36 people, and I went down this whole separate road, and who cares about the president? He's never going to tell you. Who cares about UFO sightings? You can't tell anything by watching UFO sightings. And I became interested in the experiencers who talk about this consciousness thing and interacting with the craft and all this kind of stuff, which to me was much more where the answer is going to end up. Jacques Vallée started down this road 40 years ago where he said, you know, I'm going to be very surprised if this turns out to be ETs and spacecraft. And I used to think he was nuts. And when I had the download and I started to interact with this stuff, I started to realize, and that's the main story. And it's a whole nother story. You know, almost have another show, is that the head scientist for the CIA's wife is having it go to meetings, and they're having one tomorrow night, and they will answer questions. And the story they want out right now is the story of the portal. The what? Fact that there are portals. There's one in Nevada. And the CIA's wife is in control of one of these portals. It's just the most unbelievable story. And they're having this go-to meeting. So if you send me an email, I'll put anybody on the list. My email is whitehouseufo@gmail.com. I have a mailing list that I send people whenever they have a meeting. And they're having one tomorrow night at 6 o'clock Eastern in the United States. And people can go and they can ask whatever question they want. And you got to remember, the guy who briefed Donald Trump is sitting in the room and his wife is running this meeting. And it is the most unbelievable thing where they talk about portals and they're dumping this story. And the portal story is important because it doesn't mean they got crafts, that they're flying these big, huge crafts at the speed of sound. They're moving from point to point in space. They're moving through stargates or portals. And then the CIA is dropping this story.
So this was about an hour and 30 minutes into the interview.
You can definitely tell his excitability has increased. Yes. So just for those of us who weren't part of that interview, what's the download?
Well, the download, as I understand it, is Grant having this moment of enlightenment that the UFO phenomenon is beyond just the nuts and bolts phenomenon. Okay. And he realizes that getting to the truth of the matter is not going to be found via, searching through the world of materialism. He's not going to find a document that has the answers. He's not going to find a particular person that knows everything. The real answers are held in this other realm, you know, and it's something that covers all aspects of our show. It's something that it connects everything. All the topics that we cover.
And I get that. I like that idea as well, because you start to see it when you look at the phenomena long enough. You start to see the connections and the links.
Yeah. Okay. And so I was with him on that. But then, then it just got really weird.
So what's the portal of the CIA? What?
Yeah, well, let's listen to Grant elaborate a little bit.
the rumor story is always that there's a CIA weird desk, and it deals with UFOs, paranormal phenomena, remote viewing, all this kind of stuff. And Ron Pandolfi has run this desk since 1983. And so he may have briefed the last six presidents and is in control of the UFO subject and interacts with the UFO community. He's interacted with 24 researchers that I know of. It's a bizarre story, but the fact is everybody can track who this guy was, because I believe it was the New York Times identified Ron Pandolfi as the top scientist in the CIA. He's a very high-level intelligence guy, and it appears to be his job to interact or to be the liaison with the UFO community. So people, I've got five people that I dragged into these meetings, and there's five people who are now indirectly or directly interacting with Ron Pandolfi.
And what's the next meeting? What's on the agenda? What are they going to be discussing?
It's called The Princess and the Pod, and the pod is this claim that she was dropped in a pod. Her father was some sort of the ambassador to Pakistan or something, and she comes to the White House in 1983, and the portal is given, Ronald Reagan is given in control of this portal, and she's 5 years old at the time. It's just a very bizarre story.
This sounds so far removed from everything else,
and it's happening on a go-to meeting, and this woman runs the Kashmir Foundation. She runs around the world saving turtles and stuff like that. She's very much into the ecology. And so she's got a master's degree. She's no dummy. And she's the one running the meeting with Dan Smith. And Ron will be sitting in the background. And for example, we asked in the one meeting, I convinced a guy from one of the producers from Gaia to come in and watch this thing. Well, they're doing this in the open. You can think whatever you want. They're doing this right in the open. And if you got any questions, you can go on there and ask them whatever question you want to ask them. In fact, when the MJ-12 document, you're familiar with the MJ-12 document.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
When the MJ-12 document was released in May of 1987 in Washington, D.C., Ron's in Washington, D.C., he gets a physicist who everybody knows, Bruce McAbee, and Bruce will confirm this story. Yeah. He gets Bruce McAbee, who's a believer in the MJ-12 document, to go to CIA headquarters, and he gets him a standing room only audience hours after the release of the MJ-12 document, and he lectures to the CIA inside people, these agents, about MJ-12. Now, that's disclosure. That's trying to, instead of, you know, if they put this story out to be fake, why would you bring Bruce McAbee, who's a Navy physicist, high-level guy, into CIA to lecture about UFOs and MJ-12? And Ron is just sort of stirring the pot all the time and gradually leaking, and he's notorious. He's the guy that shut the remote viewing program down in 1995. He's responsible for this. And what I say is he wasn't shutting the program down. He was just moving it from the white world to the black world. So he's a high-level guy, and it's his wife. There's no doubt. When you go, you can look her up. She has a website with the Kashmir Foundation and stuff. There's no doubt she is who she is, and there's no doubt he is who he is, and that they are doing this right out in the open. And 15 people show up. People say, oh, I want to ask questions. I want to know what's going on. And I say, well, show up at these meetings, and nobody ever shows up. There's like 15 people there, and they get to ask whatever they want, and most of the people, after they've seen it a couple times, start to think that this is for real. They're actually doing this. There's something going on here.
That is fascinating. Thank you for giving me about 10 different rabbit holes to investigate. That's fantastic. The book is Charlie Red Star, True Reports of One of North America's Biggest UFO Sightings. Congrats on the book, and we can't wait to have you back.
Thanks for your interest. I really appreciate it.
So big thanks to Grant for appearing on the show and explaining Charlie Red Star and then leaving that insane bomb.
You can't do that, Ben. You can't. You should have kept going.
We ran out of time.
I don't care. You keep going.
And I had basically put that aside. Like, I had put that in a weird mental cabinet in my brain and said, I'll just deal with that next week when I've got a lot of time to figure out what the hell he was talking about. And then, of course, I got horribly sick this week. So yesterday, I had a fever, and I'm just like, oh, I've got to figure out this pod princess from Pakistan story. And I start Googling, and I find out Ron Pandolfi, this guy that runs the weird desk at the CIA.
Allegedly, or he does.
He's real.
He's real.
Well, if you search for this guy, you will find press references to him being a CIA analyst from at least the early 90s. And he started to hit the headlines because he was instrumental in finding people who were giving technology to China, American technology.
Oh, okay.
Basically, yeah. Espionage.
Yeah.
Treason. And There's actually some WikiLeaks documents mentioning him. You know, the think tank Stratfor,
mm-hmm.
that is a think tank for all the major intelligence agencies, links to political parties, you know, very kind of deep state kind of outfit. The WikiLeaks released an email where internally Stratfor was talking about this guy, but not only talking about this guy, talking about his connection to UFOs.
Oh.
So there is, at least on the surface, a paper trail that says, yes, this guy is in the CIA. And yes, he at one stage, he was very interested in UFOs. It seems as though there was something happened with this Senate investigation in 1995. I don't want to go into all the details, but something happened in the CIA that shifted his responsibilities. And he was moved out of his analyst role, and there was speculation that he was moved into developing alternative energy sources. Now, this is where the story gets weird, because it's all...
Oh, it gets weird now?
It gets all speculation that this guy started to then start getting involved in the UFO side of things and starting to do what I would call soft disclosure.
Okay.
So he's leaking information to certain people within the UFO research community. So we find out that since the early 1990s, Pandolfi has been seeding all these stories, because that's the best way to describe these things, to this guy named Dan Smith, this longtime UFO research guy who most...
Is he real though? Because that sounds like a fake name.
Dan Smith is real.
Okay.
But he is literally a crazy old man.
Oh, all right.
I have a video here where he claims he's in MS-13.
What?
He's like
the 80, gang.
He's like 80 years old and apparently running the Guatemalan street gang MS-13. Let's take a listen.
That's what they use for what the gangs use, that kind of paint, the spray paint the walls.
Which I hear you're now...
Which I'm now MS-13. Well, I've been MS-13 for quite a while. You could ask Footman. I've been... Yes, I'm just reactivating.
Oh.
He's just been reactivated within MS-13.
I don't think it quite works that way. Not that I would know, but I don't think it works that way.
So immediately I'm like, okay, yeah, this is a little bit suspect. And... the woman who's asking him questions in this video is the princess.
Oh.
Is the Kashmiri princess who is married to Ron Pandolfi. Now, for
who also saves turtles.
Who also saves turtles. Now, for two highly secretive, you know, black ops CIA people who are disclosing UFO secrets to the world.
Yeah, they're a bit public, aren't they?
They're pretty much out there. Like, you can just go to the princess's YouTube page and her Facebook profile, and there's no, like, dark, encrypted communication between Dan Smith and Pandolfi and the princess. If you go to her page, Dan Smith is literally reading bedtime stories to their daughter. He is like just this crazy old grandpa that hangs out with them now. And I'll send you to their YouTube page in the show notes. But every second video is him just hanging out with the family. And they're kind of like, it's almost feels like they're just entertaining this old guy's fantasies. That's what it really feels like.
Yeah, I get that feeling too.
Because Dan Smith is on the Open Minds forums. He's posting all this crazy information that's coming out. So the story from the princess, in case Grant didn't explain it correctly, she's an alien from another dimension. She came through a portal in a pod and landed in Kashmir, Pakistani-controlled Kashmir in the early 1980s.
Wasn't that a Stargate episode where you can fly a craft through a Stargate? It's called Threading the Needle, isn't that?
Yeah. And then somehow... she was adopted by different parents because she's linked to like Kashmiri blood, like royal bloodlines.
Uh-huh.
So she was then, because there was a lot of political strife when she was young, at the age of 5, she was somehow smuggled to America with new parents.
Why would they use a portal?
Well, yeah, you would think she's a princess with a portal. Well, no, she did use the portal.
But why wouldn't she move the portal to go to America?
She did use the portal.
Oh, she did?
Yeah, but she had to give the portal to Ronald Reagan
That's right.
And now Ronald Reagan controls the portal.
Well, hang on. Ronald Reagan died of Alzheimer's or some other neurological disease. So he's gone.
Did he, though? Did he use a portal?
No, come on. What I'm suggesting is, does that mean that the current president has been briefed on this stuff?
Well, that's an interesting question. So I was reading Grant Cameron's latest book, Managing Magic, The Government's UFO Disclosure Plan, and he's got plenty of juicy quotes from very spurious sources on all this stuff.
Always reliable.
See, Stan Smith, this crazy old man, that is also in MS-13. And has suddenly been reactivated.
But hang on, he's in MS-13, then he's reading kids' bedtime stories.
Yes. He doesn't have any face tattoos.
Move crack without 5-0 finding out.
He's playing a role in this latest attempt to get disclosure, according to Cameron. Or if he isn't, Pandolfi certainly wants him to think he is, which I think is the clue there, is that this real guy who was in the CIA, from what I can see, is, again, just... entertaining this old man with some crazy stories. But he claims that on January the 18th, 2 days before the election, he reported that he was waiting to brief a Mike Pillsbury about what he refers to as the princess and the pod. And essentially what they were trying to do was brief Trump on the portal situation. And I'll try and summarize this down because it's a very convoluted story. But essentially... they were trying to get Trump to come to an island where they could demonstrate the portal technology.
Is this why Trump's travel bill is so high for the Secret Service?
This is why he keeps going on holidays. He's actually just trying to investigate the portal technology that they keep trying to demonstrate. And to get a backup of this, Grant received a Facebook message from a Hollywood producer who linked to a leaked new TV show coming out late this year or early next year called Counterpart. And this was somehow connected with this disclosure thing regarding portals. So I IMDb'd this TV show, Counterpart, and the show is about portals. It's basically a UN employee discovers that where he works, somewhere in Germany, they're actually hiding an interdimensional portal in the basement.
And as you do.
This is somehow part of the disclosure movement. It's going to get the public ready for when Trump unveils the portal technology.
So Stargate has been around since the 90s. You've had sliders around since the 90s. The public is okay with portal and interdimensional travel technology.
I don't know. I think the public needs to take portals more seriously. See, all those shows are very sci-fi. This is going to be like a very gritty documentary-style portal TV
Law
show.
And Order. Yeah. Portal edition.
Yes, that's exactly what it's going to be. Every crime is solved with portals. Basically. Smith then got the impression from Pandolfi that Trump had been picked to be the disclosure president and that the material he's received in the last 2 months is more than the last 26 years of talking to Pandolfi. He stated that in December of 2016, Pandolfi had met with Trump every day. Smith stated that during the campaign, there had been two briefing teams. There was one for Clinton and there was one for Trump. The first team was the hardware team. So they'd basically go in and brief Trump on UFO hardware. So like recovered crashed flying saucers, reverse engineered alien technology. And there was a software group that would basically explain, you know, it's not software. It's like the soft side. Who the aliens were, who the visitors
were. The information.
The implications. Yeah, how to deal with public disclosure, that kind of stuff. And here's the... well, here's the information in the book. Apparently, I'm just going to quote from the book. Trump said he was tired and didn't want to talk anymore with any of the hardware teams or the software teams. So Trump was just like, this alien stuff is boring. He just wasn't interested in it.
What does this do? This is terrible information. You're fired.
So apparently, to get Trump interested, they gave him what Dan Smith calls the goodie bag. And
I was just kidding. Are you serious?
No, this was, according to Smith, Trump was given this box of future technology materials. It was called the goodie bag. That was the code name for it. And supposedly Trump could use items in this box to show the captains of industry how to use the alien technology. So I just love, I love picturing this story that Trump's just going into this little goodie bag.
It's like a kid with a Lego box and he's pulling out the Lego.
And that's how Baron Trump got his time traveling fidget spinner. That's where the whole fidget spinner
it
from space
sense,
thing comes
Ben.
From. Yeah, this
it all
connects. So again, this kind of, it's such an insane story. But at the end of it, I kind of, I had myself sitting there just going, you know, all that stuff on the UFO flap, Charlie Red Star, the UFO flap over Manitoba, was so fascinating and so well researched. But at the end of this interview, I was just sitting there going, Grant, do you honestly think any of this is legitimate? I mean, this woman who thinks she's a Kashmiri princess from another dimension,
who got there through a portal,
is Laura Eisenhower level fucking insane.
Yeah. Yeah, and more so.
And maybe this Pandolfi guy has some CIA connections, but it looks like they're just having fun with a crazy old man.
Yeah, because normally if you're in a clandestine organization or a secret organization, a three-letter agency, you're not supposed to tell people about it. You're not supposed to talk about it.
And they're linking this into two different avenues of disclosure, one that involves Tom DeLonge and the other involves Trump and Pandolfi, and there's these two avenues of disclosure. I mean, it's all just getting a little bit stupid.
Bit convoluted.
Convoluted doesn't even... I mean, this is... I would equate this to the same level as David Wilcock Blue Avians nonsense.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. No, you're right. The moment that you mention princess and portals, you kind of go, yeah. I mean, how is it that different just, to Blue Avians?
I mean, just go to the princess's YouTube page and look at some of the videos she's posted where she's interviewing Dan Smith. They're just... There's nothing even interesting for me to include. It's all just nonsense.
Yeah.
Like, it's crazy. The best thing I can get out of it is a Baron Trump fidget spinner story. And I just made that up. It's not even in there.
Well, we don't know that. We're assuming.
So I'll link to all that stuff in the show notes if you want to check it out. Again, weird. He is connected with the CIA, but that doesn't mean that he can't also go off the deep end.
Oh, absolutely.
And suddenly believe in wacky UFO conspiracy.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, maybe he has been in the CIA and somehow he is in a public presence and he's gone a little bit crazy and he's using his, I guess, public presence within one of those agencies to back up his absurd argument.
Or if you were in the CIA and you had all the answers, maybe the only person you can tell is a crazy old man.
It's a crazy MS-13 member.
That's right. Yes, crazy. Maybe he does run MS-13. That's the perfect cover. It's like a 84-year-old white dude that happens to run MS-13 from within the United States.
That makes sense. Absolute perfect sense.
Just portals between Guatemala and Miami.
Yeah. Why not?
Well, let's go into some Men in Black stuff after the break in our Plus extension. That is a wrap for this head cold edition of Mysterious Universe on my behalf. Thanks.
Then we go to the heart attack edition afterwards.
Yeah. If Aaron's still with us for the Plus extension, we've got great stuff coming up. We've got Men in Black encounters. Some of the stuff you were telling me was really cool. Hopefully we get to hear some of the psychic animal stories that I...
Oh, look,
ruined
I made
for
through.
You this afternoon.
Well, you didn't ruin it for me because I was going through the book and I'm going, oh, I don't... Because I do remember vaguely that you mentioned some of these stories. So, of course, the moment that I read that, I'm like, oh, well, no, I'm not doing that because Ben mentioned that. Just not realizing that it was exactly the same book. But there are some stories I'm uncovered which you haven't touched on. So maybe we will touch on. Oh, and a very strange element to a past life regression that happened to Jenny Randles, which is what got me into looking at this book today as well.
Oh.
So I'll mention that as well. Very strange stuff.
That's coming up on our Plus extension. To get access to that, head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. All the details are there. It's $9 a month and gets you access to the big extensions we do every single week. You also get an entirely exclusive show every single Tuesday. And in addition to that, you get a 320 kilobits per second version of the show, the HQ quality that's exclusive to Plus members. You get discounts on our store. You get a totally ad-free version of the show as well. And all the features of our apps are unlocked for Plus members. Again, all the details are at mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. You'll also find the show notes on our website. Just look for Season 18, Episode 10. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Welcome back to your Plus Extension. Great to have you with us. Just imagine how many germs are in the studio right now. In the break, you're just coughing. I'm dying on the floor. Trying to stretch my back out.
I actually think that maybe both of us have come down with something.
And we're
dealing with it in very different ways. So.